From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The head of the state's Rules Review Commission thinks more North Carolina regulation should face extensive scrutiny. You'll learn why he's asking state lawmakers for help. Some legislators are taking a closer look at North Carolina's plans for natural and man-made emergencies. In the wake of Hurricane Matthew and the Charlotte riots, they say now is as good a time as any for a review. Before he was nominated to run the state transportation department, Jim Trogdon briefed lawmakers on North Carolina's long-term transportation needs. You'll hear what he had to say. And you'll learn about the latest dispute involving North Carolina's controversial Certificate of Need law. It involves an operating room in Brunswick County, not far from Wilmington. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
This week, the newly elected General Assembly will get down to the business of budgeting and policymaking for 2017. Key to these debates over ideas and legislation will be the four leaders that the members have chosen to lead them. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. He's been following the story about the leadership. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thanks a lot, Donna.
First of all, what is the split now in the Senate and the House? We know there's supermajorities again.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You've got more than 60% of each the House and the Senate is made up of Republicans. 74 to 46 is the split in the House, 35 to 15 in the Senate. The Senate Republicans actually picked up a seat net in the most recent election. And so Republican dominated both chambers.
Republicans running the show, essentially.
That's right. That's right. And so they're, and because unlike the U.S. Congress, where there's an opportunity for the minority in the Senate to place impediments to legislation, there's really not very much that a large minority could can do in their unless it's large enough to be able to, let's say, sustain a veto if the governor were to do one.
Well, you bring up the key new point in this whole discussion, that is the new governor. We have a Democrat now in the governor's seat with Roy Cooper. What role might he play in this legislative discussion?
Well, he's going to – his constitutional duty is to propose a budget, and so he will do that. And that will be essentially an outline of his priorities, because it really doesn't matter which party controls the governor's mansion. A budget is basically a wish list because the General Assembly rewrites it. So it basically does not – but it does give an idea of what priorities will be. But his role will be much more in the implementation of policy, and he can emphasize things that he approves of that the General Assembly does, and he can sort of put on the back burner things he may not like as much.
Let's talk about the leadership then. Let's start first with the Republicans, since they are in control. Senator Phil Berger out of Rockingham County will have another term as the Senate leader.
That's right. He will be back in charge of the Senate. He was someone who essentially has ruled the Senate with – it's kept a pretty tight ship there. Normally speaking, if you have very contentious legislation, there's not a lot of debate on the floor about this. A lot of things are agreed to privately. The Senate tends to be a very orderly body, and we saw during the special sessions in late December that not be the case. And so that was something that was very unusual, that you had Senator Ralph Heist from Mitchell County sort of challenge Senator Berger about the House Bill 2 repeal debate. That was almost unheard of, but that's something that we'll keep an eye on now, because we do have some other new folks in senior positions at the Senate now.
And tell us about that. Who else is really powerful other than Phil Berger in
the
Senate?
Well, they elect leaders, but the person who is really often the second most powerful member of the majority in each chamber is the chairman of the Rules Committee. Because that person is, if you will, the enforcer for the Speaker or for the Senate President pro tem, because that person is chosen by the leader. The membership, the caucuses or the membership does not choose these people. And the Rules Committee chairman determines the flow of legislation and determines what committees get the bills and what's going to come to the floor or not. And so in the case previously, you had Tom Apodaca, who was from the Asheville area, someone who was not a doctrinaire conservative, but someone who was certainly a very, very combative and very, very forceful leader. If people pay attention to Congress, the rules chairman's a lot like the whip. It's the person who actually goes around, talks individually to the members, makes sure that if something's going to come up that the leadership wants, that there are enough votes out there. If there's something the leadership doesn't want, that there are enough votes to defeat it. And so this person needs to be in really strong contact with the members. And so now we have Bill Rabin from Brunswick County, who's going to be the Rules Committee chairman, and we'll see if he's able to maintain the same level of discipline that Tom Apodaca was.
Let's move over to the House and stick with the Republicans for a couple of minutes here. Let's talk about the Speaker of the House, the number one, once Tim Moore out of Cleveland County. Let's talk about the Speaker pro tem in this case, as well as the Rules Chairman.
Right. Now, this is Sarah Stevens from Surrey County, who's going to be the new Speaker pro tem. And she's replacing Skip Stamm, who was a long-serving member of the General Assembly, someone who was a very passionate advocate for economic and social conservative issues, and someone who was very active and certainly assertive policymaker. He was someone who was very adept at drafting policy. And so Sarah Stevens is there. We'll see how her approach and personality might differ to that of Skip Stamm's. And Skip was also someone who was very affable. He was very liked by people across the aisle. You got an indication of that a little bit during the opening session on January 11th, because Sarah Stevens was co-nominated by Darrin Jackson, who's the new Democratic leader over in the House. And so there is this idea that there may be a somewhat more collegial, at least interpersonal relationships in the House than there might have been in the past.
And the rules chairman in the House, Representative David Lewis out of Harnett County, and of course the Speaker himself, Tim Moore, as we mentioned, another term Speaker.
That's right. And Tim Moore succeeded Tom Tillis, who's now in the U.S. Senate. Speaker Tillis was someone who, much like Senator Phil Berger, ran a very tight ship. The schedule ran very efficiently. Tim Moore has allowed a lot more discussion among the members. He's also allowed legislation to be considered that may not have the strongest support of members of all of his caucus. And so it's going to be interesting to see how the two chambers differ again.
So let's move to the Democrats now. And you mentioned one name already, Darrin Jackson, a Democrat out of Wake County. Well, it turns out that the leadership for the Democrats, both gentlemen, are out of Wake County.
That's right. You have Darrin Jackson from Wake County. And then on the Senate side, you have Dan Blue, the long-serving General Assembly member from both the House and the Senate from Wake County, who will be leading the Democrats in the Senate. Dan Blue is someone, again, this was of interest in that there was concern about how the Senate was going to handle the confirmation process of gubernatorial appointees by Roy Cooper. And Dan Blue was someone who said, well, yes, we absolutely have the constitutional authority to do that. And so there are sort of issues of constitutional law and procedures of the Senate. Someone who's a veteran like Dan Blue is going to be someone who will probably be Phil Berger's ally on a lot of procedural issues, where maybe not on policy, but at least the two of them have an incredible amount of institutional knowledge.
Rick, you mentioned that Governor Cooper will be presenting his budget. Now, considering that the Democrats are in the minority in both houses of the General Assembly, of course, Roy Cooper has the bully pulpit. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the budget, you mentioned it would be his priorities. Is it really, will it be a policy document, or is this essentially the political document that the Democrats will turn to and say, this is what we believe in, knowing full well that they don't have the power to pass these things?
There will be a lot of politics in the budget. There will be some areas in which there will be agreement. I would say transportation spending is one. Public safety largely will be an area of agreement. Where you'll see some real differences in politics will be on things like teacher compensation, money potentially for school choice. an interesting aspect may be money for the UNC system, because Tim Moore's chief of staff was just hired by the University of North Carolina just for a senior position. And so that may be a way to potentially help UNC out a little bit in these times. But there will be also issues. I mean, the Republicans are dedicated to getting state savings accounts as close to 12 to 15% of the general fund budget as possible. And the Democrats have been critical of that. So that may be a point in which Governor Cooper asks for more spending than the General Assembly is willing to give him.
Now, that's going to be an interesting debate as that budget gets put together. And again, we'll be hearing from the Democrats, and no doubt they'll be making their case not only for the policy, but looking forward to perhaps picking up some seats in the next election. We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina lawmakers head back to Raleigh. There's a new governor in town. Working together or working against each other, they'll make big decisions. Decisions that affect you, your wallet, your home, your business, your kids' education. To keep up with those big decisions, day by day, even minute by minute, look to Carolina Journal, a full team of reporters and analysts. They're watching the action in the state capitol. They're reporting minute by minute developments for you. Carolina Journal. It's available each month as a free newspaper and every day with updated stories at carolinajournal.com. You'll find us on Facebook, too. Share items from Carolina Journal. Share items from the John Locke Foundation. Follow us on Twitter, at Carolina Journal, at John Locke NC, and at Becky Gray. Carolina Journal, it's your go-to source for news about state government and how government affects your life. Visit carolinajournal.com today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One out of every 10 rules funneled through North Carolina state government's new rules review process has been tossed out as unnecessary or outdated. Meanwhile, about 6 out of 10 rules move forward without facing much scrutiny. But the leader of the State Rules Review Commission would like to see that change. Commission Chairman Garth Dunklin recently reminded state lawmakers about the rules review process they put in place.
That process requires agencies to take a look at their rules, dump them into one of three buckets, either unnecessary, necessary without public interest, or necessary with public interest. And the concept there was that the ones that were unnecessary would, if that report was approved by the Rules Review Commission, be removed from the code when that determination was made. The rules that were necessary without public interest would stay in the code as they were, and the rules with public interest would go through the readoption process. And my understanding and memory is that a large part of the reason this bucket system was designed is there was some concern with 25,000 rules in the administrative code that the process might prove a little bit overwhelming. And so the opportunity to put things in buckets might pare that process back a little bit.
Now that the rules review process has been tested, Dunklin says he and his colleagues have learned some lessons.
Perhaps the process has not proven as overwhelming as we thought it might be. The other thing we have learned in doing an analysis of what has fallen into these various buckets is that depending upon when you look, somewhere between 60 and 65% of the rules are falling in the necessary without public interest bucket, which from a policy perspective to some of us feels like it frustrates the intent of the process, in the sense that the rules need to see the light of day. They need to have an opportunity for the public to comment on them. They need to go through the process. If just for no other reason, then they need to be looked at periodically, which was one of the underpinning concepts.
Dunklin pointed out another quirk in the existing review process.
Another thing that we have seen that has proven frustrating to me personally, and I believe to some of the other commissioners, is that there have been public comments made about some of the rules in the reporting bucket process to agencies that we have not been able to do anything about. So what we have seen is a number of instances where folks have made comments about a rule that was necessary, classified as necessary without, but because we were limited in our way of looking at it to our standard, we had to say, well, you know, that's a pretty valid comment, and that probably ought to be talked about, but it doesn't meet our standards, so we can't move it into the has to be readopted pile.
That's Garth Dunklin, chairman of North Carolina's Rules Review Commission. How would he and his colleagues go about addressing their concerns?
The idea that we came up with was a fairly simple one. Get rid of the middle bucket so that you then have two buckets. The rule is classified by the agency as either unnecessary and removed from the code, or it goes through the readoption process. One of the things that recommended that concept to me is it really just sort of steps back closer to the original recommendation in the first place, which was that everything should go through readoption. In discussing it internally, one of the things that some people suggested is, well, why have the reporting process still if you're just going to have these two buckets? Why make agencies put them in the two buckets and go through the reporting process? One of the reasons I believe you want to keep that is because to the extent they do classify rules as unnecessary, that means when the report comes to us and we evaluate it and we determine that it's appropriate and we pass it on to you, at that point in time, that rule is removed from the code. So that allows that removal process to continue. It has also been the case where we have had some circumstances where a rule was classified as unnecessary, and there was a public comment that said that rule actually is necessary. Sometimes the agency has responded to that and reclassified the rule. Sometimes the agency has not. So in those limited circumstances where there might be a rule that an agency said was unnecessary, and there's comment around that to the point that it looks like it probably ought to be talked about more fully, then we could reclassify that into the readoption pile so it would have to go through that process. The outcome might still be that it gets repealed, but at least it went through the discourse and the public comment process. So for those two reasons, I think it's a good idea, even if you get rid of the middle bucket, to still keep the classification process because it allows those unnecessary rules to be peeled out of the code, and it does allow us to have a chance to take a look at how they've been classified.
What about the current process? Wouldn't a change cause some problems?
Things change. You learn from processes, and legislative processes change over time. And I think we've learned that we've got 60% of our code plus not being reexamined. And it may be that none of it needs to be reexamined, but it can't hurt to go through that process from my perspective. There is an ability to strike a line with people as to where they are in the process. I don't think we want to be disruptive and tell people who are already have classified things into buckets to redo that. But you can strike a line for the people who have not yet classified their rules and say, going forward, you're going to do two buckets instead of three.
Dunklin also likes the potential benefits for increased transparency in rulemaking.
Being frank, we have a really good rulemaking process in North Carolina, as I have said before, but it is not as engaged as it probably should be. This reporting process is even another step removed from the public, so the likelihood that it's generating a lot of comments is reduced. That's another reason in my mind to push the process more into the main rulemaking process. We see an awful lot of reports with virtually no comments.
Democratic State Representative Ken Waddell liked Dunklin's ideas.
I just don't want to make government so burdensome. You know, it takes for a long time for it to. We have too many regulations. Yes, I said that. And I think some of my colleagues will agree with that totally. So I just wanted to make sure that we had the process streamlined as much as you could, that the public would have the opportunity to comment and knew what times they were going to comment. Because you're right, if you don't know, it's frustrating sometimes if you don't know that you can comment on it, but you dealing with the government's frustrating. I'll leave it that way.
You're hitting on part of why this concept is being brought forward, and that is there have been a lot of instances where we have seen people sort of not realize that the train had left the station. We had the billboard rules. A bunch of people showed up here showed up at the Rules Review Commission wanting to talk about the substance of that, and that train had already left the station here. We've had that happen with any number of sets of rules. So the idea of affording the opportunity for comment, in my mind, is never a bad outcome.
That's Garth Dunklin of the North Carolina Rules Review Commission. Any change in the rules review process will require support from the State House and Senate. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. State lawmakers are taking a closer look at the way North Carolina copes with emergencies. State Senator Ronald Rabin of Harnett County recently reminded colleagues about the goal of their Emergency Management Oversight Committee.
Issues related to emergency management in North Carolina. In order to make ongoing recommendations to the General Assembly on ways to promote effective emergency preparedness, management, response, and recovery.
Rabin says it's a timely topic.
Given the kind of examples we have around the country right now, we had the unrest in Charlotte, we had Hurricane Matthew, we've got fires that are still burning out west, we've got campus incidents around the nation, and more protests that are getting larger and larger and more violent. I think if we don't address these things head on and have some sort of a plan in place and make sure we're doing the best we can, that we would not be fulfilling the charter or executing the mission.
Rabin says lawmakers need to play an active role.
I think we have to be sure we're doing our best, and we must ask the right questions. One popped into mind just day before yesterday as I was watching TV. I got to wondering if the UNC system has protocols in place and training and education for their students, like the protocol at Ohio State that says run, hide, and fight. If we don't have such things in place and the students aren't receiving orientations and someone's not taking action by way of oversight to ensure these kind of things happen, I think, again, that we're falling short of what our mission is, and I don't think we should do that. The next question would be, though, you know, if they do not have them, should they? Who's responsible for making that happen?
Rabin wants to know what has worked and what has not worked.
I think we have to make sure we're taking advantage of all the lessons learned. Lessons learned aren't there to say that anything was done right, wrong, or indifferently. It's simply to say, we did this, this happened. Maybe we can do this better the next time by doing this. That's the lessons learned and the application thereof.
Rabin advocates a proactive approach.
I believe in the end, the bottom line is, what can the General Assembly do to help prevent and or mitigate any kind of a disaster that befalls the state? I think, in my own personal opinion, we got to be doing things. You can't do anything preemptive or do any advanced training to prevent a natural disaster, but I think maybe we can kind of look into, are we doing enough to make sure that the man-made disaster, which includes terrorism, by the way, that we're doing enough to preempt those kind of things. It's one thing to police up a mess. It's another thing to prevent the mess from happening.
That's Republican State Senator Ronald Rabin. He's describing his goal as co-chairman of a legislative committee focusing on emergency management. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Before Governor Roy Cooper designated him to be North Carolina's transportation secretary, Jim Trogdon already had delivered public remarks about the future of state transportation spending. In his role as National Transportation Director at the SAS Institute, Trogdon spoke to state lawmakers about North Carolina's transportation needs.
We are the fourth fastest growing nation, state in the nation, and will be by 2030 the fourth most populated state in the nation. The future will continue to stress our existing transportation systems and increase the level of our existing challenges in both scope and scale. With a growth of 100,000 people in any given municipal area or county, we tend to see about a 5 to a 10% increase in congestion and congested miles. We will continue to see these increased transportation demands in these high growth areas specifically, but even also in some of the moderate and slower growing areas.
Trogdon pointed to specific projections.
For Asheville, by 2035, it means a 10% increase in their existing congestion level just in the Asheville municipal region alone. The Triad, 20%, and Charlotte and Raleigh regions, 50% increase in congestion. So some of the great discussion about modes and the difficulty in getting around the regions and what other modes can bring will only be exacerbated as we move forward.
Challenges extend beyond North Carolina's urban areas.
If that's the challenge in these regions, what would be the additional challenges in areas outside that may be seeing slower growth or no growth? And that is, how do we support our economy? And how do we connect to all of those regions so everyone has the ability to participate? You'll see that nationally in a lot of locations where you have significant mobility challenges. It's hard for the outlying regions to participate.
Trogdon examined the state's long-term funding needs.
Historically, we've been using our state funds to maintain our highway system and relied heavily. 47% of our additional capacity in the TIP is from federal funds. The federal gas tax is at a flat rate and has been unadjusted since the 1990s, and buying capacity has been reduced by 33% and currently must be supplemented nationally by general funds or national debt to maintain status quo. CAFE standards have increased from 27.5 miles per gallon to 35.5 miles per gallon in 2015, and will go to 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025. As CAFE standards go up, our revenues per mile decline from 1.2 cents per mile to 0.6 cents per mile, which means our per capita revenues annually will go from about $300 per capita for transportation revenues to $120 per capita for motor fuels. Our state investments per lane mile will continue to be one of the lowest in the nation. And you see regionally, as compared to other states in our region, North Carolina is just slightly above South Carolina, and South Carolina is the 50th state in the nation in state investment per lane mile. So North Carolina is currently 48th. We are overly dependent on motor fuels taxes, and we are spreading them very thin over a very large system.
What about the state's transportation spending moving forward?
As we're looking at about half of our TIP coming from federal funds, half from state funds, is it sufficient? This is the cost of P4.0 projects, which is estimated to be almost $60 billion over the next 10 years that were submitted. And then the amount that would be funded, or the funding availability, was a little less than $10 billion. So you can see, out of the next 10 years, the projects that were submitted for the STIP over that 10-year period, far greater than what the program was able to fund. And I have heard comments of folks saying, well, maybe that's because everyone has large wish lists out there. I can assure you that most of these, the MPOs and RPOs, were limited to about 20 projects, 20 to 25 that they can submit. Their list of needs over the next 10 to 15 years are much greater than what was submitted. So these are their highest priority of needs that they submit for funding in the STI process.
Trogdon highlighted the extent to which North Carolina relies on federal money for its transportation projects.
North Carolina is 47%, which is still better than a majority of the states out there. Those in blue are a higher percentage. The national average is 52. My observation is two of the states that tend to be better at delivering their needs on their statewide DOT programs, Florida and Texas. Florida is at 36% as compared to our 47% utilization of federal funds, so they are less dependent on federal funds to deliver their projects in Florida. And Texas, likewise, is 41%. So, from a big picture level, the less you can be dependent on just the federal funds and a strong percentage of federal funds to deliver TIP projects, the more flexibility and the better you can address the emerging needs across the state.
What about bonds?
Consideration for further general obligation bonds in the future will be timely in North Carolina, because the what we had authorized from 1996 have completely been utilized and are not any new available today. We've used revenue bonds, Build America bonds, private activity bonds. All of those have been used in North Carolina on various turnpike projects, and we have experience in each of those.
Are there any other funding sources to consider?
I would like to point out one that is emerging a little more rapidly in how it's being investigated nationally as far as a long-term use, and that's vehicle miles traveled. Oregon does have a pilot. Now California has entered into legislation that authorizes it as an option. Michigan and Minnesota are considering implementing pilots as well in how to use vehicle miles traveled in lieu of and allow an option for that as compared to other sources of user fees and revenue.
Trogdon examined recent changes in other states.
A vast majority are responding by doing essentially what we did in the last session here in North Carolina, and that was change or modify our motor fuels tax to index it so that we don't see the sharp swings and declines. Other states have moved from a fixed cents per gallon to either an indexed or a percentage motor fuels sales tax type applied wholesale, but a percentage fee instead of a fixed fee.
Policymakers face big decisions.
A driving question that you're faced with and all of us are faced with here in our state is what's the right scale or magnitude of each of the sources, and together, what makes the best blend for our state and our transportation needs. I think motor fuels revenue has the highest uncertainty in the long term, primarily because of the impact long term from the CAFE standards, as well as, which is not figured into those projections, the potential movement to all electric vehicles, which may happen much faster than anyone realizes. Without reliable mobility, economies can't really function very well. And so it's up to you and the rest of the partners across our state to determine what's the right objectives we should be seeking and what's the right level of resourcing.
That's Jim Trogdon speaking before Governor Roy Cooper nominated him to become North Carolina's Secretary of Transportation. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Residents of a coastal North Carolina town find themselves at the middle of a dispute over the building of a new operating room for this town of about 18,000 people. Two groups actually want to do this, and the state of North Carolina will step in to decide the matter. Catherine Restrepo, who is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Healthcare Policy, is here to explain why the state of North Carolina cares about this at all. Catherine, welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
Okay, so we are talking about Brunswick County here. Tell us what's going on. Mm-hmm,
sure. Well, Novant Health and Emerge Ortho, two different healthcare entities, they have applied for a certificate of need because they're both building ambulatory surgery centers, and there is a need for an operating room. So there are certain services and healthcare facilities that are regulated under North Carolina's certificate of need law. So they have both filed an application for a certificate of need to establish this ambulatory surgery center and build an operating room.
Let's try to help our listeners understand a little bit more about mm-hmm. this thing called certificate
yes.
of need, because it's a little bit crazy here
yes.
and complex. Why is it that the state of North Carolina even tries to decide who or where, quote, needs a medical facility?
Yes, it's this crazy centralized planning process. And if you look at the history of it, it was originally a federal mandate in the 1970s. And at the time, the goal was to cut down on healthcare cost inflation. So the federal government thought that, well, if you had this centralized state planning regulatory agency that could sort of distribute healthcare facilities and services equitably across the state, this would put, sort of slow the growth of healthcare spending if everyone has equal access or equitable access to services and hospitals across the state. But in reality, I mean, this law has not been effective. It hasn't been effective for 40 plus years now. And a while ago, the federal government said it's no longer mandatory. It's optional. But North Carolina actually has one of the strongest, most heavily regulated CON laws in the nation.
Now we have these two medical groups that have decided that there is a need in that area, and they both want to build. So why don't they both just build? It's just this permission slip.
Yeah, you think that would make sense, right?
If you would think providers
and hospitals in their own community could, you know, take that risk themselves and invest that money themselves to see if there's really a market demand for whatever they want to provide. But no, they have to go through this CON process. And so it all starts with this annual state medical facilities plan that the CON regulatory agency puts out every year. And it's an inventory of, you know, the number of MRI scans, the number of CT scans, all these different things that are regulated. And, you know, the number of hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers across the state. And so based on population growth or the volume of these services, then they determine through this complicated formula what is needed for the next year. And that's when this whole process starts, where the applicants come in and compete for these applications.
Essentially, they have to get a permission slip and have to try to compete and win permission from the state in order to build this. Meantime, of course, the people in this town are waiting and waiting and waiting.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So in the meantime, I mean, patients don't even realize that they're being denied access to care and possibly at a lower cost. I mean, if you just look at ambulatory surgery centers alone, outpatient, any care in an outpatient setting is much less expensive in a standalone facility when it's not affiliated with a hospital. Compared to that same procedure being done in a full hospital setting. There's a huge cost differential there.
So our listeners might be thinking, gee, this sounds really inefficient. Sounds like one of these things where government's involved and it's just, you know, there's paperwork, there's time, there's all sorts of things going on. Mm-hmm. But that's not the end of the story. There's actually a third group, a medical group that's involved in this. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and this is where in the process it really gets messy. So you have a couple parties, you know, competing for the same application, whether in this case it's an operating room or an MRI machine. But then a third party can come in who isn't even affiliated, who isn't even submitting an application for that MRI machine or that operating room, and they can just petition against it and say, you know, this isn't needed. It's a duplicate of services, or it's it's going to be an overinvestment in an underused type of facility or service. So, you know, this is why the state should not approve of this, even though there's a so-called need for it.
Will the state take them seriously? I mean, it sounds like maybe a fast food restaurant saying they don't want the competition from the guy who wants to move in across the street.
Right, yes. I mean, the state does look at this. There's a public comment period. There's a review process. And if I guess either of the two applicants are not pleased with the ultimate decision, then it can be taken up to the Court of Appeals or an Office of Administrative Hearing, which kind of looks at the whole application process again. So it kind of has to start from the beginning again.
Catherine, this happens repeatedly throughout the year. You and I have talked about other incidents of this certificate of need process going forward. In the legislature, there does seem to be a move afoot. There are some legislators who have started to pay attention to this, in large part because of the work that you've been doing the last several years. What are you hearing from them about this?
Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like it can be a Republican-Democrat issue, but I also think it's more of a rural-urban issue at this point, because a lot of people think that, well, they're hesitant. I mean, even a lot of people who like the idea of less regulation and more of a free market in healthcare are really hesitant on this whole CON regulation, whether it should be fully repealed or reformed for certain services or maybe an ambulatory surgery center not being regulated anymore. Because, you know, the thought behind that is, well, if you have more of a competitive healthcare market, say you have an ASC that pops up in more of a rural area, well, that could put that local community hospital at risk because it's under different rules than local community hospitals or hospitals, nonprofit hospitals in that matter. I mean, nonprofit hospitals have to open their doors to everybody and, you know, they have to provide uncompensated care to maintain their nonprofit status. So if this physician-led ambulatory surgery center comes along and siphons away lucrative services because outpatient surgery is generally very profitable, you know, that puts those local community hospitals at risk. Now, that's the argument, but if there's more transparency in healthcare, I think maybe it could be a different story. But, you know, regardless of whether you have certificate of need laws or not, rural healthcare has been struggling for many, many years, and it is an issue.
What's your recommendation when it comes to certificate of need?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, my recommendation, I think that not just certificate of need should be repealed, but I think there's a lot of other ways that healthcare should be deregulated, or there's more of an equal level playing field amongst providers to be more price transparent and to provide, you know, more accessible, affordable care for more patients.
Are there any success stories of deregulation in the healthcare area that we can point to say, see, it really can work without all of these rules?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up, because back in 2005, you know, despite North Carolina having a very stringent CON law, it opened up the market to allow gastroenterologists or stomach doctors to be able to perform colonoscopies in their own endoscopy unit. So it could be performed in an outpatient setting. And like I said before, something done in a standalone outpatient setting that's not affiliated with the hospital is much less expensive for the insurance company and for the patient. So actually, there was a 30% increase in colonoscopies, which is a good preventative health measure that people are taking advantage of because it's more cost effective too. But even with that utilization increase, Medicare still was able to save over $224 million within 6 years.
So it can be done, and we
yes.
can point to things like that to show
Absolutely.
People the way
mm-hmm.
as they start considering certificate of need in North Carolina.
Yes.
We've been talking with Catherine Restrepo. She is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Healthcare Policy. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.